that one takes me back. I think you guys have heard that before. That's definitely the hockey theme of my childhood, being a kid growing up in the States in the 90s. That's National Hockey Night from ESPN, as everybody knows. So that's where we are. We're squarely in the 90s for today's episode. So I just want to say welcome, everyone. Happy Boxing Day. For those of you who are from the States, that means it's the day after Christmas. But what you probably don't know is that this was originally established in Commonwealth nations. For those of you who are not well-versed, Commonwealth means former British territories like us, even though we don't play that game, Canada does. And it's meant to be a day to give gifts to the poor, but as many cases, today, most of the cases we know are basically just good sales on a day off, so it's simply just a shopping holiday. Go figure. Well, you know, hey, consumerism, it wins again. But anyways, you're here for a hockey discussion, and yes, that's what I've got in store for you today and here on From the Point. As always, you've got me, Danny Lambert, here to lead you on a voyage into the world of another great hockey book. I'd love to spend every episode talking about easy topics, like the stories of great players or the big games that shape the landscape as we know today. However, that's only really one side of the stories that often make up the tapestry of professional hockey yesterday and today. Many times, it's the things that happen off the ice, or in some cases, the lingering effects of the game after the player finishes his playing career. As we've discussed before, and more lately, it seems like the effect of brain injury is one of those topics that just cannot be ignored and needs to be brought more to the forefront of the discussion when we look at the game of hockey. As we saw in episode 6 when discussing Boy on Ice, the first-hand effects of repeated blows to the head and what it does to a player's quality of life, their relationships with others, and most of all, their personality and ability to navigate life situations, mostly with respect to impulse control, can be extremely damaging. The hockey world is waking up to these realities, with many journalists and medical professionals starting to tell the stories of the players whose lives are being ruined by the sport they loved and dedicated their lives towards being great at. Some of the players afflicted with lingering brain injury issues receive great care and have an excellent support system that keeps the effects of their injuries to what we would probably call a manageable point. But where things become tragic in my mind is when the issues that are not managed and a former player is abandoned by the system that took the man's sacrifice and didn't pay them back for the price that they paid to make the game great. One of those players that you might have heard of already in some circles is Joe Murphy. He's a former number one overall draft pick of the Detroit Red Wings. Murphy played 15 years in the NHL for 7 different clubs. He won a Stanley Cup with Edmonton in 1990. You'd think with an impressive resume like that, he'd be able to be in a stable place in his life at this point. But the reality is he's not. Recently, it's come to light that he's been living in the woods outside of Kenora, Ontario, using drugs and harassing the town's residents. It's certainly a huge fall and a story that's not easily told. Still, it's a story that's really important, and it's not easy to get at. But TSN reporter Rick Westhead decided to take it on in his recently published book, Finding Murph, How Joe Murphy Went From Winning a Championship to Living Homeless in the Bush. It's really a chronicle of Westhead's research and interviews with Murphy that detail his highs and lows as a player and the circumstances both in and out of his control leading to what would be Murphy's current circumstances. Also, the book is based off of interviews that were done for Westhead's documentary series that aired on TSN. And hopefully you got to see that because that's actually pretty great. And I recommend after you do this podcast that you go ahead and watch that because it really does shed a whole lot of light. And we'll play some of the interviews from that in the show today. But getting back to Westhead's journey, he really looks into the past and present of Murphy, and tells the hard story. And it's one that is often equally times really hard to read, as I'm sure it was hard to tell by Westhead. But it bears discussing because you often wonder how many others may be in his shoes right now, how many other Joe Murphys are out there. And it makes you kind of ask the question, what can we do in the future to prevent it? That's really the crux of today's episode as we jump into the warm-up and into discussing Finding Murph.
What's in there? Joe Murphy is one of many young Canadian men who go to American universities to study and play hockey. Canadian schools can't compete with free room, board, and tuition offered by their U.S. counterparts. It's several thousand miles from Vancouver to East Lansing, Michigan, and the hockey rink at Michigan State. But Murphy chose MSU's hockey scholarship over a chance to play major junior hockey back home in British Columbia.
Well, I thought this would be a good route personally for me to go, you know, to make it into the NHL. I think, you know, educational, I would have had a little education, you know, and I would have been combined into a good, you know, being able to adapt to the social life. And, you know, I think college, you know, really prepares a person, you know, in all aspects of life towards, you know, when they get into the NHL. And, you know, I think a lot of players now are going towards college and, you know, that lets them develop in practices and lets them get stronger and bigger, you know, and develop mentally and everything.
That was an interview with Joe Murphy in his own words. But what I appreciated for why I wanted to put this interview where I do is that was actually Joe while he was in college at Michigan State describing what it was like to play college hockey, be a highly touted prospect in the NCAA ranks in the mid-1980s. Because at that point, college players were starting to get respect, but they just hadn't made it over the hump as the best and weren't really perennial first-rounders like they are today. But in the case of Murphy, he became the first number one overall draft pick to come out of the NCAA. And I think it was... But that's not really what I want to concentrate and what I want you to get out of that. What I want you to get out of that at first here, as we start the discussion about where how Murphy ended up where he is just draw into and think about how lucid he was, how thoughtful he was in his discussions. And when you hear the interviews with him later on in his current state where he is, just compare the two notes and it'll help draw together some of the arguments and parts of the stories that I want to talk about and that Westhead definitely talks about in the book. So starting out the warm-up, I just want to start by saying it really the beginning of Finding Murph is just a strong one. It's one of the stronger ones I've read in a hockey book for sure. Westhead describes driving to meet up with Murphy and bringing up former NHL netminder Trevor Kidd, who's also a TSN analyst, with him to sort of bridge the gap and you know, have somebody that Murphy might remember from his playing days to start the introduction. It was Westhead's fear from the beginning of just what he would encounter, you know, the unknown, that draws you in and really makes you just start to fuel the story from the beginning as he describes the circumstances that led him to meet up with Joe that day in Kenora. I think another big thing that'll draw you into the book and what definitely drew me in as well and what made me want to read it was the title. Sure, I mean, I'll say this. I remember Joe Murphy. I saw him on TV. I had his hockey cards. I knew he had won the Stanley Cup in 1990 with the Oilers. I played him on NHL many multiple seasons because I was kind of a closet Blues fan, but that's a whole nother story. But like many who have moved on from the game who weren't like my absolute favorites or famous personalities, I really didn't pay attention to what their life was like after hockey and where they've gone. But when I read that title, it just made me wonder, what am I missing here? Should I have kept up with Murphy? What's the issue? Add to that the description of Westhead's feelings heading to meet Murphy for the first time, and you're just sort of ready for a story of ups and downs that makes you feel sort of, for lack of a better term, bad for not knowing before you read about the book what Murphy's life was and where he had gone after hockey. Murphy's career, as alluded to earlier, was pretty solid. That fact alone, that he signed a few multi-million dollar contracts, makes you ask, how did this happen? How did Murphy fall so far? I mean, we all have heard stories of professional athletes blowing through their fortunes. I mean, that's nothing new. But in the case of Murphy, it was that he went even further down that to basically living homeless in the bush, as the title implies. I mean, it's one thing to get kicked out of your McMansion and lose your Ferrari. It's another thing completely to be homeless and living in the woods. It's a complicated story, and it's one that Westhead tells very well. I think it's the fact that he does a great job to completely lay out Murphy's life, not only in hockey, but his personal life, his relationships as well. Westhead paints a picture of Murphy that helps you realize that in some cases, the decisions and circumstances of Murphy's life that led him to this point were not necessarily of his making, and sometimes many of them were completely, but sometimes some of them were of his making. It's a dichotomy that makes you constantly wonder throughout the book, should you blame Murphy for creating his own prison, or should you blame the others or hockey or the possible brain injuries that he more than likely suffered from playing hockey? What was to blame? What got Joe Murphy to where he is today? And that's really what the book is about, making you think about that. Once again, like many of the reporter-authored books that I've read in the past, I just got to give Westhead a lot of kudos. He does a lot of great research into his topic, and then, you know, by getting firsthand accounts, and then just sort of weaving it into the tapestry of the story, making it that much better. I personally felt like I saw all the angles of his story and finished the book with some solid answers, yet still some questions to contemplate, as you should at the end of any journey into a topic that's complicated. It's only natural to have questions that you need to still contemplate, and especially when you look at what happened to Joe Murphy. So when looking at an approach on how to discuss this book, I think it's best to follow the blueprints that Westhead laid out in the book, but my thought is not necessarily to go at it chronologically like the book or even like I've done in past episodes. To get the full picture of why Joe is where he is now, I think we'd get a lot more out of a discussion that centers around talking about things that were in Murphy's control that he sort of mishandled, then move on to circumstances that were sort of out of his control, things that were beyond things that he could wrangle in or control, and then sort of, you know, finish the discussion of why he can't get out of the terrible place that his life has led him to at this point. So with all that in mind, let's get into the first period. As we go over some of the mistakes of Joe Murphy's making that got him to, as the book says, living homeless in the bush. Stand by, the first period's up next.
The Kid Line, 22-year-olds Joe Murphy and Adam Graves and 19-year-old Martin Shelinov. Their youth is vital to this veteran club.
If you got a house without any kids in it, your house is pretty empty, but as soon as you put some kids in there, things start to happen. And that's really what happened with our team. We got to the position that we had pretty much a veteran hockey team, and as soon as we put some kids in there, the veterans started to act like kids again, and we got the speed and determination back again, and it's made a lot of difference to the team. They're really the ingredient that we needed.
You know, all three of us want to win a Stanley Cup and get a ring is more than anything. I think it's just a great, great thing that all three of us can play together and work for that same goal. And
you know, when you play with those guys, you always look better, and that's just perfect play with those guys.
And they come to the rink with so much enthusiasm, and they work so hard that, you know, you expect that at least the effort and the enthusiasm that they show, you expect that of yourself, because otherwise you feel you'd be letting them down.
So you definitely recognize the voice who leads that segment right there. That's the great Doc Emmerich back in 1990 talking about the Kid Line, which was the very famous line of the 1990 Oilers that was made up of Joe Murphy, Martin Jelena, and Adam Graves as they led the Oilers to the 1990 Stanley Cup championship. What I really want you to clue into, though, is a lot like the last interview with Murphy, is just how thoughtful he was, how lucid he was, how his thoughts were, and what he thought about the game. And more importantly, take away from it, too, that at that point with that Oilers squad, he had definitely made a name for himself, realized a lot of potential that people had thought he had, and was starting to make a name for himself at the top of the NHL. But when we look at the first period, I just want to say that to start, that we really need to sort of start at the circumstances that led to Murphy's life and what was sort of in his control. So it kind of starts at the beginning. And I know I said I wasn't going to go chronological, but for this part, we definitely need to start there. It was kind of obvious from the beginning that he was going to go places. This was a talented kid. When he was growing up in Vancouver, everybody knew that his natural abilities were going to take him pretty far. But as many would explain, it was observed that even in those early playing days that Murphy wasn't really much of a hard worker. He really wasn't going to do the extra things to get better. And oftentimes it just seemed like he might be hard to coach. It's just sort of an aloofness, really, is the best way to describe it. So going into junior hockey in the BCHL, that reputation would largely continue. He had issues adjusting to the structure and life in junior hockey in Penticton. Teammates told Westhead that Murphy seemed to be just out of it in many cases and not engaged enough. No real big discipline issues, as it was the absent-minded space cadet kind of things. You know, missing practices, waking up late, that kind of stuff. Still, he was putting up good numbers and getting noticed and finishing the season, that first season in Penticton, with 152 points. As one of the highest recruited talents in 1985, Murphy got attention from major junior squads and NCAA programs. He and his family decided to go the NCAA route in the end, and so Murphy became the probably what would be the biggest prospect in Canada ever to snub major junior to make the move to the NCAA when he committed to Michigan State for the 85-86 season. As expected, at Michigan State, Murphy was great on the score sheet. He amassed 61 points in 35 games and was one of the big pieces that brought the Spartans an NCAA championship in 1986. At Michigan State, the coaches and teammates had many of the same observations once again, but some absent-mindedness and spacey behavior, really, but nothing that seemed to be a real big problem. The great season for the Spartans only solidified Murphy as a great talent, and as expected, he was in the mix for the number one overall spot in the 86 NHL draft. The Red Wings were deciding between drafting Murphy or Jimmy Carson, but in the end, Wings GM Jimmy DeVellano and his team took Joe. He became the first number one overall pick from the ranks of the NCAA, and as such, there were a lot of expectations based on that, which we'll get back to in the next period. But the reason I mention it now is because that would make Murphy's miscues that would come up later just even more of an issue. Joe should have been aware of that as he left East Lansing after only 1 year in school to start with the Red Wings, but it seemed to be that his aloof nature and didn't really seem to put two and two together that there would be serious sort of expectations put on him by the Red Wings. Murphy should have known that once he started as a number one overall pick in the NHL, he needed to show maturity, that he really wasn't showing up to this point. He'd have to step up his game. All that being said, it was noticed right away by the Red Wings management that Joe was talented, but had oftentimes not focused. And this led to issues between the player and the club. It was thought that Murphy had the talent to start straight away with the big club in the NHL. But because he missed a flight in that first preseason to a road game, it was decided that Murphy would need to start with the Wings AHL squad in Adirondack. While in Adirondack, Joe struggled to find his touch on the ice. He only scored 21 goals in his first season in the A, and with 5 games in Detroit that year, he only netted 1 assist. That underperformance largely continued for the next 2 seasons as Murphy struggled to find his stride and largely split time between Adirondack and Detroit. It wasn't till Adirondack's run to the 1989 Calder Cup championship did Murphy really start to stand out and begin to live up to expectations, scoring 17 points in 16 playoff games that year. Still, the Red Wings weren't completely convinced that Murphy had turned the corner and parlayed his successes and decided to move him after only 9 games in the 89-90 season to Edmonton for Jimmy Carson, the player that they had really hoped to draft in hindsight, considering the perceived problems that they had with Murphy. The move ended up being great, though, for Murph, as he plugged into and was a major competitor with the Oilers Cup-winning team in 1990, as alluded to earlier. Mark Messier was the captain of the Oilers, and he had made a great place to play and really decided to take all the young players like Murph under his wing and kept them in the fold producing. And he also found a big ally in Glenn Sather, too, who also saw past Joe's past indiscretions or reputation with the Red Wings and really understood the player that he could be. And like we talked about, the kid line of Murphy, Adam Graves, and Martin Jelena was just amazing, and it offered a great secondary scoring punch for those Oilers teams. Murphy would spend 2 more seasons with the Oilers, and it seemed like he was thriving and finally found his forever spot. But as players got siphoned off out of Edmonton, it became a harder place to stay. And when it came time to renegotiate his contract, Murphy overplayed his hand for more salary and ended up moving on to Chicago. With the Blackhawks, Joe had less structure and more freedom, which he started into bad habits, mostly fueled by partying with friends like Bernie Nichols and some mistakes with money and investments, making chaos in his life that led to his divorce, thus making another guardrail that was taken out of his life. His play was strong at the beginning with Chicago, but it began to decline slightly, and with the rise of other wingers on the Hawks, he became less and less valuable to the club as time went by. He trusted his father as an attorney and agent to negotiate his contract extension with the Blackhawks, but he misrepresented Joe's wishes, which was to stay with Chicago, and instead committed Joe to sign with St. Louis for a bigger contract. Westhead implies here that Joe's father was looking for a bigger commission and not necessarily doing what was best for Joe, who knew the Blues were not in an ideal spot at that point. So in St. Louis, Joe would find himself in a new town, isolated from any support system and added pressures to live up to the big contract he had just signed, which was not great for someone like Murphy, as we'll discuss further in the next period. Add to that the hard season, that first hard season under Mike Keenan, a big injury and further declining play. He was just never really able to live up to that contract and was shipped out to San Jose to finish out his contract. With the Sharks, he looked to be back in a support system with his friend Bernie Nichols once again, who had sort of mellowed out a bit, and he played well enough to get a contract offer, it was thought, but the team decided to move on. So after San Jose, that's really where things went downhill fast for Joe. That summer, after getting not renewed by San Jose, he wasn't getting any offers, but he kept his head down and was able to get a tryout with the New York Rangers, who were ready to bring Joe into the fold and have him sign, because GM Neil Smith at the time had been the GM in Adirondack when Joe was playing there and knew that Joe was a talent and really wanted to see if he could exploit that talent for the Rangers. But strangely enough, after only a week into that tryout contract with the Rangers, Joe signed with the Bruins. And oddly enough, his excuse was quite strange. He actually accused Neil Smith, his former GM, who, like we said, was trying to help Murph, of trying to sabotage him by cutting up his sticks and throwing his skates in the river. Nobody knew what that one was about, but as we'll discuss later on in the next period, you'll probably be able to figure out a little bit was probably behind that. With the Bruins, Joe's play was lackluster, and his behavior became even more bizarre. He was not really friendly to teammates, and he cursed out Pat Burns on top of it, which really led to his release by Boston after only 26 games in the 99-2000 season. And then, as fate would have it, he was actually picked up when put on waivers by Washington, and he was put on a short lease when GM George McPhee brought him in, and Ron Wilson, the coach, actually said, "Hey, look, we need to make sure that you're accountable." So it looked like he was in a decent situation, but it would be an off-ice altercation in New York during the next season, during the 2000-2001 season, where Murphy started a fight and was arrested, and then that led to him being sent down to the Capitals AHL affiliate, which he didn't want to report to, and that ended up ending his career. So after his playing days ended, Murph initially had lots of money. He had a decent nest egg built up from his playing days, but he blew through it pretty quickly in a series of impulsive decisions. He bought horrible real estate investments. He spent fortunes on gambling, and he even moved to Costa Rica to start a business, which ended up going nowhere and costing him what was left of his playing days nest egg, which is estimated to be over about $13 million. Of earnings over his 15 years of NHL service. After returning from Central America, Joe returned to Ontario and tried to slug things out, being a deep cleaning contractor, doing things like coaching junior hockey, but he ended up getting fired out of both of those because of really aggressive behavior. He looked to mentor players towards professional careers as well, but he ended up being really unreliable and unstable. And then, you know, he just ended up not being able to go anywhere at that point, and that's when he started to end up on the streets and eventually in Kenora, taking drugs and drinking despite many of the outreaches of people that we'll discuss a little bit further. So as you can see, it really was, you know, sort of an aloofness and impulses that really tubed Murph's career and has kept him down in his post-playing days. It's easy at first glance to say if Joe would have played this situation this way or had been more that way about some of the conflicts or showing more care in certain situations, he might have done a little bit better for himself. I'll say this. I think it's kind of just a personality thing, really. I've seen plenty of people like Joe who act like they don't care, but they actually care a bunch. But for the people who receive that behavior, it just seems like they don't care. The impulsive crazy stuff is two things. One is that he was most likely never really told how to handle the stress correctly. And that's a failing of others. And then second, which we'll talk about more here in the next period, there just seemed to be something inside him that couldn't control himself. I mean, do you blame this on Murphy? At face value, yeah, sure, you should. But once again, I think we're going to get into a little bit more here later. So as we look to the second period, I could say a little is on Murph for a situation, except for not giving more of it. Really, all he could really do is give more of a care, I think. Not much else. Sure, it would have helped him to be more enthusiastic and follow the rules to the nines, but sometimes it's really people who are who they are. And you just have to really, bend around them and find a way to reach them, even through their quirks. In the end, it seems it really is just some things that were outside of his control that really led to where he is now. And we'll discuss those factors outside of his control coming up in the second period.
Your shots on the Edmonton team. What a vicious slash. I don't know if we'll get a chance to look at it. Mironov really took it out on Mike Gratzky.
And now Mironov getting into it with one of the Sharks on his way off the ice. And it is Joe Murphy. And he's unloading on Boris Mironov. And now the players have joined in the hallway. And this thing's getting ugly. Out of control and out of the reach of three of the four officials.
Well, Murphy is in an area he's not supposed to be in. That's the hallway to the Edmonton bench.
Well, he used to play here.
Yeah. It seems like home for him. He was obviously really upset with Mironov, jumps over the bench, and there might be some disciplinary action to Joe Murphy for doing that.
Or to Mironov for the slash. How did four officials not call a penalty?
Well, he was being sent off the ice, so obviously he was getting a penalty.
No, you're right.
But the slash, and I'd like to see it. It might have been just on the stick of Mike Gratzky. If not, it was the back of the leg of Gratzky. There's Joe Murphy. He is still in that area. In fact, he's going to have to climb out of the Edmonton Oilers box.
I think he just got confused which dressing room to go to.
Well, he's going to get thrown out.
All of this coming with 40.8 seconds left to go. Here's another look.
Well, he's in there already. Now, I don't know if he fell in the gate or whether he jumped over. It's almost impossible to jump over. I think he must have fallen in, and maybe if we get a chance, we'll back it up a little bit. And here you see.
Kind of looks like Mironov pulled him in.
Could have been. And right after Mironov pulled him in, there was a number of white jerseys who ganged up on Murphy. I'm sure he was getting his fair share of noogies. Well, he might have fallen. See, now, there's a little gate between.
So that was a clip from a game Murphy was in when he was playing in San Jose. It's weird. It's at Northlands Coliseum where he used to play, and they're playing Edmonton, and he is in the hallway leading to the dressing room for the Oilers, which meant he had to jump over the bench and be in the way to start a fight with one of the Oilers, which is sort of off-putting, and it kind of really shows you where he was at the end of his career, just kind of thought-wise, that he would actually do something that crazy, because when you look at it at the beginning of his career, he's all about scoring goals. He's not trying to do that stuff, but something antagonized him enough, and he sort of, you know, lost control. So that's really what we're going to kind of talk about here in the second period. So most people in life understand or subscribe to the idea that a person is almost exclusively responsible for their actions. In many cases, it's pretty clear if an individual has made decisions that have caused them to arrive at a bad place, they are the reason for it, and thus very little of your time should be spent on them. At first glance, that looks to be the case with Joe Murphy, like we discussed. There were definitely some things that Murphy had done to sort of get himself to where he was. It looks mainly like it's his fault that he's homeless. I mean, and addicted to drugs because the bad decisions that he made. It's easy for people to say that. As we detailed in the last period, Murphy was certainly to blame for some of the miscues over his career. But what if I told you, though, his bad decisions could be explained? And that once you hear that, an explanation, you'd wonder, was it really his complete fault that he is where he is today? The ability to control impulses is perhaps one of the most important things a healthy brain can provide a person. If we acted on all the thoughts in our head, it'd be a crazy life for sure. The frontal lobe of the brain provides a person with the ability to filter out information and to really, quote, stop and think before acting. If that frontal lobe doesn't develop properly or is damaged, the effect is that a person becomes more difficult because they can't really think clearly enough to control their own behavior. They don't have enough pause, really. Westhead makes it clear in the book that he thinks the frontal lobe brain injury is the root cause of Joe Murphy's downfall. It explains a lot of the behavior of Murphy and helps to correlate him to many of the different stories of hockey players and athletes that have suffered similar trauma. It's a sound hypothesis and really explains a lot. Furthermore, one of the issues with brain injuries is pinpointing it down to an incident or incidents that cause it. For example, when we looked at Derek Bougard and Boy on Ice, author John Branch knew that Derek had CTE because of the pummelings he took over the years and that he was diagnosed post-mortem. But he really couldn't tell you about the one concussion or the one hit that caused his downslide. In Finding Murph, Westhead makes it clear, and Murphy confirms it, the brain trauma Joe suffers from today can really be pinpointed to one big hit that he sustained in his career. That hit came on January 9th, 1991 in a game with his former team, the Detroit Red Wings. Sean Burr, who was a teammate of his, Murph's in Detroit, ended up hitting Murph so hard that while his head was down around the Oilers' goal, he flew in the air and hit his head at a 90-degree angle against the boards at the base of the glass. The hit was so hard that Murphy says it broke his skull, but no medical records were found to corroborate his story. The even weirder part to me is that Murphy didn't even leave the game after that. He didn't miss a shift. As a matter of fact, he played more in that game. And as the story is told, he got a breakaway later in the game and shot 30 to 40 feet wide and still wasn't taken out of the game. He couldn't see straight because he'd been knocked so hard by Burr. And he really missed no time at all and continued to play after that. But friends and family thought he should have had time to heal and more time, and probably ended up doing more damage, really, in the end, in the process of continuing to play. Joe's sister Kathy told Westhead that the brain damage from that hit and not being properly attended to was what was his biggest impediment in how Murphy has handled himself in the last couple of years especially. She was quoted as saying, quote, "I definitely noticed changes. You could see that he was starting to do erratic things. He was starting to do drugs. He was starting to drink. If he didn't have a brain injury, he wouldn't be doing these drugs." And she really, you know, confirms it, that after that big hit, he just wasn't himself. As Murph puts it himself, you get your bell rung, and self-medicating both with alcohol and with painkillers and the toll that it takes on the players after doing that year after year. is high. It seems like the other that just seems like the other tragic stories you've heard of in the cycle of injury, addiction, and impulse control issues, and then the issues that lead to alienation and possibly death in the case of others. So looking at Murphy's timeline after the 1990-91 season, when he received that hit, he only played one more season with Edmonton and then jumped to Chicago. It was the issues of him leaving Edmonton and then the excesses in Chicago that really started the downward spiral for him. The funny part is that it can all be traced back to that hit from Burr. Westhead's theory is pretty sound in my opinion. The Sean Burr hit damaged Murph so much that he was unable to function correctly and needed help to cope with his injury. It was help that he just didn't get. In Chicago, Murphy didn't have accountability like he did in Edmonton, like he had under Mark Messier and under Glenn Sather. He also had another issue, that the partying and the change in emotional health led to his divorce and further allowed for him to fuel his extra time with drugs, drinking, and gambling, because he now almost had zero accountability in his life. Teammates could have done more for him, for sure, but they just didn't. Still, it was friends in Chicago that at least provided some guardrails. When he moved to St. Louis, he didn't have that anymore. Then in San Jose, the guardrails were back a little bit, so he did okay again. But after leaving there, he had nothing in Boston or Washington, and thus his career ended because he couldn't control his impulses and no one was there to guide him, as his own brain really left him rudderless. Pile on the end of career incidents in Boston and Washington and all the events that happened right afterwards, in which he spent all his money. And you can see that impulse control is definitely something that Murphy was suffering from. Gambling, ill-advised real estate ventures, the move to Central America, it just really highlights what I just said. Impulse control is not something that Joe Murphy was able to exercise because of his frontal lobe injuries. And with no guardrails in the form of social circles or coping mechanisms, Joe really has suffered. It seems that many have taken advantage of him for this reason as well, and in some cases the family that should have been there has either had enough of his instability, passed on, or simply not given enough effort to keep up with Joe. That being said, when looking at the crux of this discussion, it's easy to say that Murphy should have sought help for his issues or just known better. But that's kind of naive considering when we can say that with almost certainty he doesn't have the control faculties, and it's largely accepted that people with brain injuries such as his cannot make these decisions in some cases. So what were the things that were out of his control? Really, almost all of it. Since that hit from Burr, as he was unable to fix the underlying issue that led to friction that ended his career and ended up in the erratic behavior that ended up spending all of his money. And really, that's ultimately what put him on the streets. And then he turned to drug issues to basically self-medicate. And that's what's keeping him there. And that's where we really want to go to end this tilt. And discuss Murphy's life now and what he can do to change his life, if anything. But, you know, we really want to talk about how that plan has not been and may never be able to get him off the streets. It seems like it's an easy thing to fix, but it's a little more complicated than that. And that's what we want to discuss as the third period's up next.
I've made some good decisions, but also some not some good, so good decisions. But right now it's been going kind of better for me. My health has been good. After I got back in Thunder Bay, the health has been well, and I do a lot of walking and moving around. I've gotten to know every square inch of the area. I've walked it maybe 10 times over, 1,000 times, and I'm in a better position.
We've always had a homeless issue. Some of our older people, that's all they've known, right? They prefer to be homeless.
Well, the Fellowship Center is a place where you can gather yourself, you can have a shower, you can get a start to the day. It's open from 8 to 5. You can get out of the heat of the rain, and you can just collect your thoughts.
Well, he has his issues, but he's always been respectful when he comes here. And, you know, he asks for things, and And we try to give what we can for him. And like I said, he's never given us any problems. And then he doesn't stay long. He gets what he needs, shower, whatever, shoes, clothing, some food, and then he'll leave.
I guess I do like being alone.
Joe's future? I hope he doesn't end up on our memorial wall. I really don't. You know, it would be awesome if he could reconnect with his family. But in the meantime, while he's here, we'll take care of him, and God hoping, you know, he'll be okay.
So that was an interview that Murph did after he got back from what we'll discuss a little bit later was a long-term therapy in Thunder Bay, and then immediately went right back to Kenora. And his discussion of what his life is after that and how he feels. And you see, he says he feels great, but I think in actuality, that's sort of the disconnect and one of the tragedies about the conditions that he's dealing with. The other voice that you hear in there is one of the counselors that runs the shelter that Murphy frequents and talks about that Murphy's actually a pretty gentle guy and that he's a good spirit. I think that's the interesting part about what we talk about, just how somebody can say that they don't have a problem with him, but there's definitely, Westhead, I'll definitely put in the book that there were plenty of problems with Joe Murphy around town, and if you watch the documentary, you'll hear some of those stories. So looking at the third period, for me, to start out, when I read Westhead's words, the hardest points, you know, to accept or where towards the end of the book, they were just the hardest things to read. It was specifically the discussions of what Murph's life on the street was like. The recap of his playing days, to me, wasn't that hard to take. Because for as much as Joe did those things to sabotage himself, first out of absent-minded aloofness and then out of lack of impulse control, it always seemed to me that he was able to take the money that he made in hockey and keep himself in a relatively stable place. After his playing days, you see it kind of take a slow burn into the life that he leads now. But now that he's there, you just kept expecting to hear a happy ending. Something was going to change for him. But Westhead's story really doesn't end with the interview of Trevor Kidd in 2018. It goes on for about a year and a half after that. And what's most compelling is that Westhead explains how attempts are being made to help Murph. It's just not really taking. He's received assistance financially in the form of disability from pensions from the NHLPA, and he's also received, he's received enough funds from them to stay in extended stay motels. Adam Graves has even pitched in a little bit of money here and there. But what they say is, you know, he pays his rent and then pretty much uses the rest on drugs. There's even been talk of him receiving a settlement in a class action lawsuit that was resolved between the NHLPA and NHL. But Murphy has explained to reporters that he really doesn't want that money and is refusing to deal with the lawyers, mostly because of the issues he thinks that are going to go with having that money. Furthermore, he says he considers many attempts to help as just attempts to control him, to control his life. There have been a long line of counselors who've tried to help him as well and tried to get him off the streets. None of it's helped. He's even placed into a live-in program and moved to Thunder Bay to participate in that in March of 2019 after being ordered by the courts for an evaluation. It looked like things were going to move in a positive direction. I remember reading that thinking, okay, now this could be the tipping point. But after leaving treatment, only a few months after that, he just went right back to Kenora after only a few months in treatment and right back to his old habits. As of August of this year, it was reported by CTV that Murphy was actually living in Regina with the intent to go back to Ontario. So it's not like Joe hasn't been offered assistance. The idea that he hasn't fully accepted or in some cases even at all makes for a discussion of why. Is it just natural to wonder what the block is that isn't allowing Joe to accept the help he needs? And I think that's just really the tragedy of the situation, that there's something blocking that. Sure, it's easy to blame blame it on the drug addiction or simply that Murphy is a troubled person with mental issues. But those are, and those are valid, but if you hang your hat on those issues alone and move on, you're missing so much. Because those behaviors have always been there for Joe early on, but he was able to control them, or at least have the moment of pause to think about it, about his thoughts, and ask, what do I need to do to help to get through this situation? But when you take his brain injuries into account and how they kept him from that impulse control and how they keep him from that pause, from that moment, you can see it's really the reason behind why Murph is on the streets and why he can't climb out of it, the situation he's in. He's refusing help because he can't see the help as a way out. He sees it through the lens of mental illness that can't be controlled because his brain lacks the ability to discern. Sure, many have tried to act as that external discernment, but they have largely failed because they can't get Murphy out of his own head, which is operating in a defective manner. And to me, that's the only way out for Joe. He needs someone to act as the guardrails for him because his mind can't do that. Still, is there anyone out there that trusts him, that he trusts enough to do that? It really just appears not. Could a strong family member or a friend do that? I'm not sure, but I don't think that he's so far gone. I just think he's so far gone. You can't do that. It's just a tragic story, and one that mental health professionals would tell you plays out a lot when a person can't even get, seek, or even accept the help they need. Take that a step further and wonder in the case of, and you got to wonder in the case of Murph and in so many other hockey players like him, why it is that the sport that they loved and worked so hard to be successful at simply cast them aside after all, when it was the sport that left them in a hole of mental illness caused by the brain injuries they sustained during their playing days. It's too tragic when you drill it down, and why it just didn't have to happen in the first place. Now that we know what we know about these players and what they're going through, why doesn't the NHL do more to prevent it and do more to take care of those who have been injured? I think that's another big tragedy. Would a more active program help Joe? I'd say that's really hard to determine, but I can't say for sure what I can say for sure is that maybe it has been on most people's radars earlier. Maybe he could have learned the skills that would have kept him from the life he knows, and he could have been reached before it got too late. That's not too much to ask, really, is to just be serious about taking care of the people who make the game great before they ruin their lives because of the injuries they've sustained while playing. Really, they need to learn how to cope with the things that have happened to them, and I think that's where we're failing in some cases.
He asked for help, and he wasn't long out of the league. The league let him down.
Joe's sister, Kathy.
He deserves to have help. He didn't do anything wrong. It's easy to pass judgment and say, you know, he's crazy, he's eccentric. He didn't go in crazy and eccentric. So tell me, what happened along the way?
The NHL and its fans will say, well, this is because Joe made bad choices. What do you think about that?
I think when you have brain injury and people to make judgment like that, I have no idea what they're talking about. His mind doesn't think like a normal person's mind thinks.
How did it affect you? What did you...
It affected me physically, mentally. It just affected... I just couldn't function. And in everyday life, I could, but I still had to function, and it was scary.
He's passed out, and he's, you know, come to on the floor and doesn't know why he's gotten there. His brain cannot focus. He has a hard time getting up. It's like a heavy depression. He's thought of ways of killing himself, you know, just to relieve the pain of this.
Only thing I could really say is that this was not like a pre-existing condition that he had. This was not who he was when I knew him. There was no eccentric, unusual behavior. He was a very normal, happy, bright, funny, extremely generous person.
So what you heard right there is a clip from the documentary that Westhead did that really spawned the book. What I really liked about this one is the voice you heard there was his sister, Kathy. That's Joe's sister, Kathy, talking about what she felt the immediate and long-term effects of his injuries have been to his brain and just what it's like to be Joe. And there's even a little bit of talk in there from Joe about what he thinks the brain injuries have done to his life and how it affects him on a daily basis. So yeah, this has really been a hard one to go over. And the book is obviously a hard read. I mean, it's hard to read about tragedy. It leaves you wondering, you know, what is Joe's issues? Are they completely mental? Are they things that can be treated? Are they things that are too far gone? I mean, does he have CTE? Can he be helped at all? Rick Westhead tells this story to make you think. To show you the whole arc of brain injury, what brain injury can do to a person if not identified and treated. And I often think that that's the issue for most, like, with mental health issues. As long as it stays out of our ways, we're good with it if it doesn't affect us. We like to watch hits and fights in hockey, but when it comes to making sure that the players who receive the brunt of them are okay, are we doing what we can? Are we making sure that they're fine after sustaining such hits? Do we ask ourselves, do we need to be encouraging this? It's easy to cast all this aside and say that the player knows the risks and is fairly compensated for their risk and injury. But really, are they? Are they given the tools to deal with the loss of impulse control and breakup of their support system because no one wants to be around them? In the case of Joe Murphy, $13 million wasn't enough because money doesn't support. Only people can support by caring and offering support through other things that really have nothing to do with money. But as I've alluded to and explained, caring won't get Murph out of this hole now. Maybe it's something that just needs to be prevented, because the damage that could be permanent and unable to be repaired. I think of Derek Bougard in the case again, and really what his mother said in an interview one time that I played during that episode, that she didn't think anyone could have helped Derek stop the issues that led to his death. And I draw an eerily similar parallel to Murphy, because it seems no one can stop Murph from living the self-destructive life he's living currently. So really where I want to take you now is just say, please take a moment and read this book. It's important because Westhead does a great job to put a human story to a real problem. The dedication to write this book I felt was tremendous. I also think that the mix of science and story are just great. This book is heavy on Joe's story because Westhead is looking to paint the picture of his life before brain injury and then his life after brain injury, and let the reader know that there is a difference, and that difference is the brain injury he received and how he now has to deal with it. Finally, I think it's worth mentioning that this book is good at giving a detail level where detail is needed. There's no dwelling too much on specific games or series and trying to recreate them. It's really just a good background when it comes to the hockey. Westhead keeps the focus, though, on Murph, the man, not the player per se. So once again, go out and read this book. Please, it's very important. It's a very important book to read. Okay, well, that's all I've got for this week. Although I feel like I could go longer, I can promise you we'll be talking about this issue again, and so we'll live to fight another day here. So as always, this is where I thank you so much for your support and for spending an hour on a great hockey book with me. Also, if you've liked what you've heard, please give me and the show a subscribe on your favorite place for podcasts, and also give us a follow on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for facts all week about the books we feature. Okay then, so as we put this episode in the books, I'm looking forward to next week when we go over J.R., My Life as the Most Outspoken, Fearless, Hard-Hitting Man in Hockey by Jeremy Roenick and Kevin Allen. It's about another strong hockey life, and it's a lot to unpack because, well, it's J.R. Okay then. So take care, eat some Christmas leftovers, and as always, stay classy, hockey fans. Thanks a bunch. I'm Danny Lambert, and this has been From the Point.